You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Sex workers are entitled to the same human rights standards as other members of Canadian society, but the current criminal laws mean that they are forced to live and work in dangerous conditions where their constitutional rights are routinely infringed. 2 years ago, Pivot Legal Society produced a report that called for sweeping changes to the Criminal Code of Canada to bring an end to this imbalance. This week, Pivot Legal released a second report that looks ahead to the day when prostitution is decriminalized to see what other aspects of Canadian law will need to change to accommodate the needs of sex workers. Katrina Pacey is a lawyer and co-author of the report, and she joins me on the phone this morning. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, why did you decide to look beyond the discussion about criminalization and start talking about what would come next?
Well, we did that for a couple of reasons. First of all, when I was presenting to the Parliamentary Subcommittee on Solicitation Laws, which is the federal committee that's contemplating criminal law reform, it became really obvious that they were concerned about letting go of the regulatory role that the criminal law plays. So if they decriminalize it, they're ultimately letting go of control to the other levels of government. And I could tell they had some concerns about because they didn't know how provinces and municipalities would deal with it. The second reason is because we really thought it was important for provinces and cities to start looking ahead at the issues that they would be faced with if the criminal laws were repealed.
Now, if adult prostitution is decriminalized, what kinds of laws will start to apply?
Well, it really opens the door for, you know, a number of possibilities, and that the report sets out 10 areas that are specifically become sort of invoked if the criminal laws are repealed. So at the provincial level, such things as employment standards, labor standards, and the capacity to unionize, there are some issues around, you know, access to human rights protections and family law issues. And then at the federal level, there's still issues within their jurisdiction, such as access to employment insurance and taxation law and so forth.
Now, as part of your process in producing this report, you talk to sex workers themselves about what areas of law are relevant to their work and how they feel about that. Who did you talk to?
Well, we spoke with 84 sex workers from different areas of the industry, and we tried to get as much diversity as we could in terms of experience. So we spoke with sex workers, male, female, and transgendered from the escort industry, from massage parlors, as well as sex workers who work independently out of their homes, as well as street level.
Now, I want to ask you in a bit more detail about a couple of areas that you dealt with. And let's start with municipal laws, and particularly with licensing. What is the current situation in Vancouver?
Well, we call it a quasi-legal system because I think people are pretty aware that we have a system set up where a lot of prostitution does take place indoors. It takes place in the context of massage parlors as well as escort agencies. And in some ways, these are legal businesses because they buy licenses from the City of Vancouver and they operate and they pay taxes and they do all of the appropriate things. But nevertheless, prostitution does take place in these venues, and as such, they are actually infringing the criminal law. So what we have is, we call it a two-tiered system. We have an indoor system where very little criminal law enforcement actually takes place, and these businesses are allowed to operate. And then we have a street level, which you know, a lot of sex workers who are living in poverty end up working at street level, and they end up being confronted by police and so forth in the context of their work.
So what did the sex workers that you talked to say about the issue of licensing?
Well, they have a number of different views on it. I mean, a lot of sex workers really felt that obviously, you know, licensing exists and licensing for businesses is part of our society, and they accept that. And they also accept licensing as part of being accepted in as a business and as a legitimate business. However, there were concerns based on experiences in other jurisdictions and even in other cities around the world where licensing actually ends up having the impact is that it ends up creating, again, a black market. And the reason why, at least an illicit market, and the reason is that there are sex workers out there who, for various reasons, can't actually make it to City Hall, can't purchase a license, or are unwilling to. And so that might be because of issues of marginalization and just social social barriers, such as an economic barrier. They can't pay for the license. They face other struggles in terms of just making it up to 12th and Cambie and putting their name down on paper. But more than that, there's also major privacy concerns for a lot of sex workers. So what they overall said was that as businesses, they accept that businesses that are more than four sex workers or four employees, that they accept that that a license would be required. However, what they asked for was to have individuals and independent sex workers and small sex worker collectives, small businesses, to be excluded from licensing requirements so that they could have flexibility, privacy, and not be subject to a potentially punitive system.
Yeah, I understand that they were raising concerns similar to ones that would be raised by musicians who play music on the street in terms of the difficult nature of dealing with licensing.
Yeah, I mean, it adds an extra layer to the requirements of their work. And a lot of sex workers work in this industry somewhat informally. They do it when they, on top of their regular work. They do it when they, need to make ends meet. They do it for a whole host of reasons. And what ultimately what they said is that because they move in and out of the industry, because they move in and out of this kind of work, and because they want to have their privacy protected, given the stigma attached to it, that was really important for them to not be required to do that.
Now, another area of discussion was income tax law, and sex workers talked about some of the benefits of actually becoming part of the mainstream system, paying income tax. What were some of the benefits that they noted?
Well, again, they really recognize it's part of being a contributing member of society, that by contributing to income tax, you are providing funds towards, the types of benefits that Canadians enjoy. And they really recognize that that's an important thing to do and would like to do that. However, what they said is right now they aren't realizing a lot of the benefits that result from paying income tax, and they don't have access to those benefits presently, despite the fact that many sex workers do pay tax presently. So they recognize that they want to do that, but they also want to have equal access to the benefits of income tax payments.
And some of the benefits would be things like paying into CPP, getting mat leave, buying RSPs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right, is having all of those benefits, as well as less, other benefits that are actually less measurable, such as equal access to police protection, equal access to health care and health care provision, and to not face discrimination when they go for those types of services. Now, again, that's not something that's particularly tangible or measurable in the same way that an access to a pension would be, but it's equally important.
What were some of the negatives that they talked about when they talked about income tax?
Well, in particular, one thing that is a major concern is if the industry was completely decriminalized and all of a sudden it was no longer sort of on the fringes, it was no longer part of an illicit market, and sex workers were working above board, they're concerned that if, for those workers who are not paying tax presently, because they don't want to reveal the source of their income, that they would fear retroactive taxation, so audits, and we saw this actually in the adult film industry, was that some workers who were working in the pornography industry were coming forward and acknowledging their income and were getting audited for the 10, 15 years prior, because they realized that income tax wanted to know where their income had come from previously. So we have concerns about retroactive taxation, and that was something that we recommended in the report, that they create a sort of a form of an amnesty, in fact, that if a sex worker is all of a sudden reporting income, that she not be audited as a result.
What's the current attitude of Revenue Canada towards sex workers?
Well, interestingly, in Canada right now, proceeds of crime is taxable. So regardless of where your income comes from, even if it's from, some type of illicit work, even if it was from trafficking in drugs or running a body house, it is taxable income. So presently, obviously, Revenue Canada doesn't have a problem collecting a portion of taxing proceeds of crime, which is an interesting fact that a lot of Canadians don't realize.
It is an interesting fact.
Mm-hmm. And so in fact, that type, you know, any sex work is actually taxable presently. And we don't know what their attitudes are in terms of, you know, how they would deal with it. But what we are asking for is that they do some sensitivity training and some awareness raising with their staff and everybody that works for Revenue Canada, so that they realize that that some sex workers might be starting to file taxes for the first time, and that they might need assistance with that, and also that they should have sensitivity towards and not discriminate against sex workers in the process of communicating with them and so forth.
Well, there was an interesting story from one of the sex workers that this person, I can't remember if it was a man or a woman, was talking to a Revenue Canada worker and saying, well, can I claim the cost of condoms, which is it's a health and safety issue, and it's should be a tax-deductible expense, and the Revenue Canada worker just laughed at them.
Yeah, so like any business person, if you are an independent business person, they want to be able to write off business-related expenses. So there's an interesting, more detailed discussion about that in the longer version of our report, which really goes into, you know, what would the scope of that be? And as you can imagine, there were some pretty creative discussions and hilarious discussions about what exactly is a business-related expense in the sex industry and what would they be able to deduct.
Well, one of the things that really struck me when I was reading the report was how your approach of going to sex workers and asking them about how the law would affect them brought up things that if you're not in that industry, you would never think of.
And that's right. And that's always been Pivot's underlying premise, is that really you can't look at this issue and you can't think about this issue in any type of informed way without the voices of sex workers. And because they're marginalized and because they're criminalized, that's a really, sometimes that's a really difficult voice to get to or to access. So we're really urging law and policymakers to listen to them and create safe avenues for this type of information to come forward, because, you know, there's information in this report that, as you just said, would, myself as part of the sort of straight world would just never come up with these types of recommendations, just because I just don't know how the industry operates from the inside.
What is the status of the debate on decriminalization right now in Parliament?
Well, we have a parliamentary subcommittee, which was struck as a result of a motion from Libby Davies, I guess a couple of years ago now, it feels like. And the committee's been up and running on two separate occasions and never made it too far because there were two elections called. Now we have, under the current government, the committee's back up and running. We know that the committee, when they had their last round of hearings and so forth, did get to the point where they were able to draft a report, and the report was making its way, or they were making their way through the report, and we're going to vote on it, whether or not it would become a recommendation to go to the Human Rights Subcommittee. And unfortunately, the election was called, and they didn't get to the final stage of voting. So we're, at this point, the committee's up and running, other than the fact that the Conservatives haven't appointed their members. And they're going to continue where they left off, and we really hope that that report makes it to at least become a public document so we can see what their recommendations are.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me this morning, Katrina.
Thanks, Jane.
I've been speaking with Katrina Pacey. She's one of the authors of the report Beyond Decriminalization. It was released this week by Pivot Legal Society. You can read the report online at pivotlegal.org. You can find a direct link from our website, cooperadio.org/redeye.